I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me and an option to present you some new ideas, proposals for non-resonant cooling of atoms, possibly molecules, with the help of feedback-controlled laser cooling schemes. So you know about a lot of success in laser cooling. Nobel Prizes were given for this. But most of the current cooling schemes that we know are based on resonant atom field interaction. So to cool, you have a very limited selection of atoms that you're able to cool. And to cool, you need to have a closed spectroscopic transition in the atom. When atom absorbs a photon, it gets a kick in the direction of the photon propagation. Then it re-emits a photon spontaneously in a random direction. And if you are able to repeat the cycle again and again, eventually you can slow the atom or even to stop it completely. Well, the requirement for this scheme is you need very convenient closed spectroscopic transition consisting of closed scheme consisting of only several levels. And as I said already, there is a very limited set of atoms and laser frequencies which fit this requirement. Therefore, it's not surprising that the deepest stages of cooling needed to produce BEC I achieved with the help of evaporative cooling. This is a generic technique similar to usual evaporation. It's rather general, but it has deficiency because after the cooling, almost 99% of the particles trapped in a trap are lost as a result of this evaporative cooling. So this is the reason that there is a constant search for alternative methods for using lasers to cool atoms, which are not based on exact resonance between atomic between atomic transition and laser frequency. So the ideas that we will discuss today, they involve cavity cooling. I'll come to this a little bit later. But part of the ideas actually people borrowed from particle physics, from the tools that people use in high energy physics, so from accelerators. So if you accelerators are usually used to accelerate the particles, but you are able in principle to make them working in the opposite direction. So for instance, the group of Meyer and some other people, they created electrostatic decelerators of molecular beams that take a very monochromatic molecular beam, propagate them through a set of high voltage electrodes, and the voltage between electrodes is time dependent, and it's switched in such a way that molecules, they always see a force in the direction opposite to the propagation. So this is a walking device. It's accelerator walking in the opposite direction, and it's demonstrated it used for accumulation of dipole molecules. It has considerable size. It's not a tabletop device, but of considerable size. Another exciting idea, which was borrowed from particle physics, actually relates to a stochastic cooling method. And this technique was invented in the 80s and actually finally led to a Nobel Prize in physics. And it was initially designed for cooling beams of charged particles in the direction propagation to the perpendicular to the propagation of the beam. So when you have a beam of charged particles moving along a closed trajectory, they have a dispersion of the position along the middle, the mean trajectory. And the question was how to make this beam brighter than it is and allow intense collisions, so on. And Vandermeer came with the idea of stochastic cooling, which works like this. You have a beam, you have two electrodes here, and this electrode, which is called pickup electrode, it measures deviation of ideally of every particle in the beam from the central position. Actually, they, of course, address not a single particle, but a bunch of particles. After they measured the position of the particle with respect to the mean position, they produced an electric signal which is amplified by electronics and controls the other electrode, a kicker electrode, which corrects, applies a kick to the particles and corrects the trajectory when they make half a round trip. Well, and as I thought, it worked perfectly in the case of charged particles, and recently Mark Risen and some other people, they tried to transfer these ideas to neutral atoms. They wanted to develop a technique of stochastic cooling of neutral atoms using lasers. And of course, when you go to the neutral atoms, everything becomes much more complicated because you don't have the degree of control over the particle motion as you have for the charged particles. So they try to imitate almost completely the scheme of the van der Meer. So for this, they need several components to be developed. If they have gas of particles trapped in a trap, they need to be able spatially resolve velocity distribution of the particles in a given spatial domain. This is something similar to this peak-up electrode measurement. And then after making this measurement, they should be able to compensate for the error in the position of this group in the particle in the phase space, analog of the kicker electrode. And this can be done, for instance, with the help of accelerating optical stand waves. So each of the components of the needed components was demonstrated experimentally. But up to the moment, as I know, to the best of my knowledge, this is still a proposal and it was not realized experimentally. So we tried last year to devise a scheme which potentially lifts out all these restrictions, and this is what how it works, and we expect that it will be an operative scheme soon. So let us consider two counter-propagating laser beams of the same frequency, which form a standing wave because of the interference. And these waves, they have identical amplitudes and they have a relative phase between them which may be controlled. Actually, by changing this relative phase, you're able to change the position of the standing wave in space. Now we put particles inside the standing wave and consider the interaction of the optical field with the particle is a non-resonant one, which means that the particle may be characterized by its non-resonant polarizability. So no exact resonances here like in resonant atomic cooling. Because of the interaction with the standing optical field, the particle feels the potential energy, which is proportional to the square of the amplitude, to the polarizability, and it's modulated, the potential energy is modulated in space at double spatial frequency, and the position of this periodic potential in space is controlled by this phase, which is the same phase, relative phase between two laser beams. Well, when you take a single particle moving non-resonantly interacting with a standing wave, it performs a conservative motion over this potential, and the total energy of the particle is of course conserved. At every moment of time, the total energy of the particle consists of the kinetic energy and potential energy. Each of them changes with time, but the sum is constant. Assume now that you are able to shift suddenly the potential, optical potential, say by a sudden change in the relative phase between optical fields. If you do it fast enough, the kinetic energy of the particle will remain the same. Particle has inertia. It simply cannot move during the shift. But the potential energy can be reduced. As a result, the total energy of the particle can be reduced. And if you continue this game again and again, you can eventually extract most of the energy from the particle. Of course, you want to play this game not with a single particle, you want to do it with a collection of particles. And to do this, you need to know in which direction you should suddenly shift potential, when you should do it, and how big should be the phase shift which leads to the extraction of the energy. So how can we get an idea about all this, how can we get answers about, to all these questions? For this, we have to measure a total force that a standing wave applies to the whole collection of the particles. The total force is the sum of individual forces acting on each individual atom, and each individual force depends on the exact position of the atom in the standing wave. So we need to take individual forces, you need to sum them, and to get this force. Of course, this is not a way to do it experimentally, to measure each individual force and then to collect them. But the sum, fortunately, the sum of all the forces applied to the ensemble of particles can be measured optically. And the reason for this is the following. What is the physical reason for the force acting from the standing wave on a particle? It comes from the rescattering of photons from one of the laser beams to the another one. Because this is a process without any absorption, only scattering is involved. So even if at the beginning you have a two laser beam of the same intensity, after they pass through the sample, the intensities of these two beams will be different. Because a part of the photons will go from this beam to that beam as a result of the scattering of the particles. The difference between the fluxes of two photonic energies going in this direction and in that direction divided by the speed of light is exactly the force that atoms apply to the photonic field. And according to the third Newton's law, this is the force that atoms feel from the photonic field. So the recipe to measure the force is the following. Take two detectors, put them here, measure two signals as a function of time, apply it to the scheme that calculates the difference between these two signals, and divide by C, and as a result you get a force. You get a force, you know the direction of the force. Now, if you know, for instance, that a standing wave applies a force to the whole ensemble to the right, that means that ensemble of the particle wants to move to the right, because if it moves to the right, the potential energy will be smaller. That means that now if we make a sudden shift of the potential to the left, the potential energy of the system will decrease. So more mathematically, we also wanted to say that this scheme is not just a theoretical speculation. This is a real experimental scheme that was used by a group of Riesel to perform some experiments with the feedback control of atomic clouds. Well, more specifically, the change in phase that we need to apply to a standing wave in order to reduce potential energy to the maximum possible value at a given time t is defined by this equation. We should shift the potential by such an amount that after the shift, the force acting on the ensemble is zero. Well, fortunately, this equation can be solved and this needed phase shift can be found only using the results of two measurements. At any given time t, you need to measure the force applied from the standing wave to the ensemble of particles. And also what you need to do, you need to suddenly change this phase between wave beams by pi over 2, measure the force again, the ratio of these two forces, or the ratio of these two power differences will give you the needed phase shift. And what is really interesting is that the needed phase shift depends only on the ratio of two signals measured by photodetectors. And this is very good for the calibration of the system. So we don't need to do an absolute measurement. Well, so here is a scheme for the optical shaker that potentially can cool our particles. We have a standing wave here. We have the system of two photodetectors. We have a differential, something that calculates the difference between them. We have a block that decides what should be the phase shift based on these measured signals. And this block controls the phase modulator which is placed in one of the arm of this scheme, and it shifts suddenly the whole standing wave. And if the shift is done in the right direction and by right amount, you on every step you extract the energy from the system. Well, a little bit of theory. How can we expect what is the rate of cooling if you do it this way? Well, the force that a collection of atoms feels from the standing wave is a sum of individual forces, and because the position of every atom is more or less random with respect to the standing wave, you can probably safely approximate the sum as a random Gaussian process with zero mean value and the variance which is proportional to the square root of the particles. The same very similar argument applies to the force calculated at the phase shifted by pi over 2. But because this is not a natural force that ensemble feels, this is a quantity which is actually proportional to the total potential energy of the ensemble, which also fluctuates in time. So it again can be approximated as a random Gaussian process, another Gaussian process with the dispersion square root of n. Plus, it has some non-zero mean value because some of the particles are trapped by the standing waves, and this gives you non-zero mean, which is proportional not to the square root of n, but to the n, actual number of particles. And it can be shown that for a thermal ensemble, at least, the ratio of the particles trapped by the standing wave is given by this quantity. Now, we can calculate the energy loss of the particle for a given shift. We need to average this energy loss over the random process, two random Gaussian processes A and B, and the result is dependent on a parameter, a very important parameter, which is the ratio of the power measurement detected by two detectors to this characteristic product of the temperature and optical frequency. It can be shown that as a function of this universal parameter, the energy loss related to the temperature of the system has a very specific form. It saturates when this parameter is bigger than one. And finally, for the specific parameter bigger than one, the loss per one jump it becomes independent on the wave intensity and also becomes independent on the number of particles. So that means that from one jump of the standing wave, on average, you extract kT over 2 portion of energy, and that means that you have need about n cycles of these jumps to be performed in order to substantially cool the system. And this is, by the way, a general property of all stochastic cooling schemes, so we were not surprised to find it here as well. Now, how it works. Here we have a collection of particles trapped in a parabolic potential, and on the top of this parabolic potential was superimposed this shaking standing wave. And I hope it will work. Oops. You see a superposition of the harmonic potential and standing wave. Now, shaker is working. The horizontal line shows you the average energy of the system. You show how the energy is going down. You see that more and more particles are accumulating at the bottom of the potential. Some of them are trapped, and those particles which are trapped, they do not participate anymore substantially in the process of cooling, and this is the reason why the rate of cooling is decreasing with time. By the end of this cooling cycle, we will adiabatically switch off the standing wave. And you see, finally, we come to this parabolic potential with substantially reduced energy, and here you have the same picture, but to the right you see the phase space of the system. The big circle shows you the initial phase space that was occupied by the system, and this solid line shows you the reduced phase space. So we really have a concentration of the particles in the phase space. So we change the phase volume of the system, and this does not contradict to the Lewin theory, because our system is a system with a feedback. Okay, so after we understood this, why don't we design an even a simpler system? Why should we bother about the exact measurement of the difference between these two photodetectors? Because we know at least that if this photodetector measures a flux bigger than that, that means that more photons are moving to the right, this means probably that the atomic system feels a force directed to the left. So if the system feels a force directed to the left, that means that if we shift a little bit potential to the right, we will, on average, lose the energy, not gain the energy. So now, instead of calculating exactly the needed phase shift, let us assume that we want to move our potential randomly to the right and to the left with a constant, relatively small phase shift. But the direction of this phase shift will depend on the sign of the difference between the measurement between these two detectors. So now we measure only the sign of the signal, but not the absolute value of the signal. Well, the system is simplified considerably. We don't have a scale here. We don't have this guy sitting here making some decisions. Well, to make this scheme effective, we need to guarantee the cooling. We need to make this constant phase shift, plus minus delta phi zero, small enough. And now we have a trade-off. If it's very small, the rate of cooling is negligible. If it's large enough, then you have a chance to miss the right position of the standing wave. So you need to find an optimal constant phase shift that on average will maximize the energy extracted from the system. Fortunately, our random Gaussian models, simple models that I described before, allows us to find this optimal phase shift. It again depends on this universal parameter that I described before. And finally, we see that in this single measurement scheme, the average total loss of energy per jump is kT over pi. I remind you last time it was kT over 2. So, of course, we lose a little bit in the rate, but the scheme becomes much more simple, and we hope that probably this implementation will be the first one when it will be realized experimentally. Well, this slide shows you a comparison between two shaker schemes that I described. The first one, in which every shift of the potential led to the extraction of the energy, and the second one when the energy was extracted on average. So sometimes you have pluses, sometimes you have minuses, but on average you lose the energy. And of course it's not that impressive, that impressive as the left one, but it's much, much more simple. Now what limits the operational efficiency of the scheme? Of course noise of different kinds, all the delays in the system are not positive for its operation. For instance, if the laser field experience some intensity jitter, well, you will accumulate errors, and we have simple estimate what is the heating rate produced by the intensity noise. And by the way, people who are doing trapping of atoms in dipole forces, they no formulas of this kind for a long time. So when this heating rate due to the intensity noise exceeds the cooling rate, of course we should lose the efficiency of our cooling. And this is illustrated by direct numerical simulation of our cooling scheme in the presence of the intensity noise. When there is no noise, we have our best cooling result. When you add some intensity noise, cooling becomes less and less efficient, and finally there is a border after which you have heating instead of cooling. And of course the same relates to the noise in phase, because if the phase of the laser beam is, and the phase of the phase modulator that you incorporated in the system is not fixed, is fluctuating a little bit, again you can lose your cooling efficiency. But there is a relatively wide range of parameters experimentally accessible in which you can get distinct and robust cooling. Well, a proposal for experiment well looks like this. If you take, for instance, about 10 to the 6 cesium-like atoms, not cesium atoms, cesium-like atoms, because cesium is a rather complicated atom, and form a shaker by formed by two Gaussian beams, focused, tightly focused, and you have detuned transition, so you are not close tuned to resonance. Then the estimation shows that our shaker can start cooling not from the room temperature, but from the temperature which is about 10 to the 5 recoil energies, and the laser power needed for this is about microwatt, and the cooling time, the time in which you extract a considerable part of the energy, several seconds. And current techniques for trapping of cold atoms in dipole traps, people are able to trap them for several hundreds of seconds, so this is within the current technological limits. Let me probably skip some example of the optical shaker result feedback and come to this part related to the cavity cooling. Cavity cooling is another way of that people thought, invented for cooling of particles without making use of resonant transition. So in any case, to cool the particles you need a dissipation channel. In resonant cooling, this channel is a spontaneous emission. So we need something which dissipates from the system. And the idea was the following. Let's take a collection of non-resonant particles. Oh, let's take a single non-resonant particle and put it inside the cavity in which you have a standing wave, a mode in the form of the standing wave. If the coupling of the cavity to the particle is strong enough, in principle, even a single particle is able to detune your resonator from the resonance with the external field. And when a particle moves inside the standing waves, the coupling to the field becomes stronger and weaker, stronger and weaker, and so on. So when particle performs such a motion, for instance, when it's in the node of the electromagnetic field, the field doesn't feel the presence of the particle. When particle is in the antinode, it's like you put a piece of the dielectric material inside the cavity. You detune the cavity, and if the light is tuned to the bull side of the atomic transition, as a result of the detuning, the photonic energy of the photons in the cavity will be shifted to the bull side. And then these photons leave the cavity being more bullish than they were before, and as a result, the system loses the energy, and at the expense of the kinetic energy of the atoms. Well, actually, this cooling, cavity cooling scheme was realized in experiment a couple of years ago by Rempe. And it for the efficient operation of this group, it's important to have high finesse cavity. The field should have some inertia. It should not follow adiabatically the motion of the particle inside the field. Just recently, we found that we can, well, these are equations that describe electric field inside the cavity. So the derivative of the electric field inside the cavity comes from the pump, from the external field, losses through the neurons, some detuning from the resonator, and what is more important, dispersive path, which describes the change of the dielectric properties of the effective medium inside the resonator, depending on the position of the atom. Those of you who are a little bit, say, of my age, not the most of the audience, they remember about optical bistability, a field that people studied in the 80s. So in principle, you know that if you introduce a feedback, if you pumping electric field, it depends on the internal field inside the cavity, the stationary solutions for the field inside the cavity can be multistable. Well, just without going into detail, I want to show that if the pumping field depends on the internal field in a sigmoidal way, you can find multiple stationary solutions for such a resonator. Yeah, I am going to the end. So for a given external exciting intensity, your resonator may exist in two stable states. And this is very interesting for you because this is there is a possibility to use the transitions between these two states in order to extract the energy. And just by changing the position of the particle inside the resonator, the internal fields at certain positions can suddenly change, and the field is spilled out of the resonator. And the particles which are inside the resonator have reduced kinetic energy. And because I have to go a little bit faster, let me show you that in principle you can put a particle in a bistable resonator and considerably reduce its energy much faster compared to the usual cavity cooling that people demonstrated in the past. And well, let me go to the summary. I showed you that, in principle, using a feedback control in atomic ensembles coupled to the standing waves by suddenly the parameters of the standing wave, you can achieve feedback control with the cooling. And I demonstrated you two schemes, optical shaker in more details, and cooling in bistable resonator a little bit briefly. And with this, I want to finish, and I thank you for your attention.